Hello and welcome to Mysteries of Science. I'm Dan, the editor of Science and Nature, the monthly magazine from the team behind The Week Junior.
And I'm Kieran, the features editor. Today we are going to be talking about one of my favourite cryptozoological animals of all time. And that word, cryptozoological, means that it's something that's not actually proven to exist.
Yeah, what a great word. Well, we've tackled a few different cryptozoological mysteries before. Let me think, Bigfoot, do you remember that one? And Loch Ness Monster, they spring to mind. But today we're searching for something even bigger. Dragons.
This is so exciting. They are one of the most widespread fantastical beasts of all, I think it's fair to say. They turn up in stories and legends all the way across Africa, Asia, and Europe. And even today, they keep flying back into our lives through films, TV shows, and books.
So our investigation is going to take us all around the world and back to the time of the dinosaurs. On the way, we're going to meet a real-life dragon tamer, an expert on prehistoric creatures, and the wonderful Cressida Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon and the current Children's Laureate. I am determined to find proof of dragons existing today.
All right, well, let's see what we can do. We are off to a flying start. See what I did there? Let's go. This is Mysteries of Science.
For once, Kieran, I'm not going to start with me and you. I'm going to go straight to one of our experts.
Hello, my name's Cressida Cowell, and I am the author and the illustrator of the How to Train Your Dragon books, and I'm also the current Waterstones Children's Laureate. I suppose what I'm trying to do about writing about dragons is to make you feel the wonder and how extraordinary the natural world is. How amazingly adapted the creatures that live on this planet are to the environment that they live in, and how we really need to look after that. That's what dragons represent to me, and that's why it's so endlessly fascinating writing about.
Dragons are like the perfect creation because they're just so adaptable. Cressida's dragons from How to Train Your Dragons are ridden by Vikings, the great explorers of history, while medieval European dragons were these fire-breathing monsters, and ancient Greek dragons were actually water serpents.
Yeah, if you go further east, you pass through the evil lairs of the Middle Eastern dragons and the Egyptian god, I think it's Apepi, who ruled their world of darkness and chaos. If you go across to East Asia, the stories of dragons represent many different things. So, for example, in China and their mythology, the dragon is heavenly and represents royalty and something that can rule well. Whilst in Japan, the counterpart there is a shapeshifter. And both of those types of dragon are wingless, unlike some of the others that we know of.
But let's not forget the UK itself, of course. Wales, the land of dragons, and my home country, that's represented by a great big red dragon too.
Yeah, there are so many different but shared ideas of dragons. And that makes you think, did they once exist? You know, how else would so many different cultures all create reasonably similar stories of reptilian monsters or creatures that could, depending on where you're looking, fly, breathe fire, hoard treasure, defeat entire armies, or on the opposite hand, represent peace and power and majesty?
Yes, that's interesting, because of course people across the world have believed in dragons, from as far away as China and Japan to Scandinavia, where the Vikings were. And I partly think it's because they found dinosaur bones, and because dragons of course look a lot like dinosaurs, and some dinosaurs look very like dragons indeed, the pterodactyls and things like that. So I think they probably found those bones, or the bones of a sperm whale, for instance, looks very like a dragon when it's dried out. And then they made up this idea of what dragons might be.
I absolutely love this idea because, of course, dinosaurs are very dragon-like. And, you know, perhaps dragons never existed as this unique creature, but their stories were inspired by dinosaur bones. I think it's a really lovely idea, and I wonder whether Cressida is onto something here. So let's find out.
Hi, my name's Nick Crumpton. I'm a biologist, but I'm also a writer of children's books, and I've just written a book called Everything You Know About Dinosaurs Is Wrong.
Nick knows his stuff. He wrote a brilliant article for us in a recent issue of Science of Nature. So we asked him to take us back right to the very beginning of dinosaur studies.
Kind of in the 1670s, that's when in the UK, in the West, one of the first sort of dinosaur bones to be described, it turned out to be Megalosaurus, you know, many, many years later, first had the kind of scientific treatment, as it were. The scientific treatment in the 1670s was very different to the scientific treatment today, so it was very obvious that this was part of a huge leg bone, but the folks at the time thought perhaps it could be part of a leg bone of an enormous giant or something. There was absolutely nothing in their mind that said, okay, this is an enormous reptile.
1670 isn't that long ago when you think about it. The first Homo sapiens, that's our species, human beings, they'd been around for around, let's see, 300,000 years by that point. And that's more than enough time for them to find dinosaur bones, not dragon bones, dinosaur bones, and misinterpret them as dragons, and then like begin to make up stories about them. Anyway, let's listen to what Nick's got to say.
So yeah, it took a long, long time for scientific rigor to actually work out what these creatures were. You know, the 1840s was the first time that the word dinosaur was ever used. So us studying dinosaurs scientifically, it hasn't been a very long time. I mean, from the 1840s to now, that's not a very long time.
This is adding some weight to this theory, isn't it? That dragons are just misunderstood dinosaurs.
Well, yeah, not only that as well, but some dinosaurs are very similar to types of dragons that we know. I'm desperate to find out more about this.
Okay, all right, this is fun. So let's think, what do dragons do? So I suppose fire breathing is the big one, right? So, you know, dragons, fire, they kind of go. So there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that any animal will probably ever be able to breathe fire. But, you know, there are animals today that do sort of breathe, as it were, other kinds of fire. You know, there are snakes that have, that are able to shoot toxins out of their mouths. There isn't any evidence for dinosaurs that there were any venomous or toxic dinosaurs. Usually you can find that by looking at their teeth. There are telltale signs to show if an animal was able to inject venom. So dinosaurs have been portrayed sometimes in the media, like in films, spitting out venom. So I'm thinking of the Dilophosaurus in Jurassic Park. There's absolutely no evidence that we know of that shows that any dinosaurs could spit venom. In fact, the whole part of the animal family tree, the archosaurs, so today birds and crocodiles and alligators, none of them are toxic or venomous. That's all on the other side of the reptilian family tree, on lizards and snakes, but they're quite distantly related from dinosaurs. Also, remembering that modern day dinosaurs are birds, there are some birds that use projectile vomit as a bit of a defense mechanism. So some albatrosses sort of, you know, vomit at predators when they get too close. So potentially, you know, that's something that, you know, their relative 66 million years ago, maybe they had similar defenses.
Well, I don't know where that leaves us, Kieran. Can we make that, can we chalk that up as a partial success for our theories there? That they may have had an ability to breathe things out, like a bit like fire breathing, maybe, possibly, but we can't prove it. What do you reckon?
I think let's chalk that up as a negative for our dragon check, but there could be something else.
Let's have a think. What else do dragons do? So hoarding treasure? So obviously, I guess a lot of animals look after their own treasure. They kind of, you know, look after their eggs and they protect those. So we know that certainly some dinosaurs, it does look like that they looked after their eggs very, very very well, very maternally. So a dinosaur called Sitapati was discovered sort of sat over its nest. So if we imagine that it probably had feathers coming off its arms, then most likely it was sort of hoarding, as it were, you know, protecting its young, which in a way is its treasure.
It's sort of another half win there, isn't it? You know, dinosaurs aren't quite like Smaug. Was that how you say his name? I realise I've never said that out loud before. Smaug?
I don't know. Smaug. Smaug, I'd say, but...
The dragon from The Hobbit, you know, very famous for hoarding treasure. But I suppose if we're sticking with our theory of, you know, people found fossils and misunderstood them, maybe they could have come across dinosaur fossils that showed sort of the shape of an animal protecting something, and that could have been misinterpreted, I suppose.
And then I guess the last thing that we can think about, you know, the last thing that dragons do is fly. So obviously, yes, some dinosaurs could fly. We know that they, a certain line of dinosaurs became birds. So all birds that are alive today are not only descended from, but are, biologically speaking, true dinosaurs. But we very recently discovered a remarkable fossil of an animal that lived probably in the trees. It was a dinosaur. It's got an incredibly short name. It's just called Yi, which is spelled Y-I. And that's the Chinese character for wing. And it had these sort of skin-like membranous connections between its fingers. But at the very least, it could have glided between the trees in a very similar way to other gliding animals today, but on wings that would have looked quite dragon-like.
Oh, wow. This is great. And this one's a new one for me. So some dinosaurs, like some dragons, could fly. I mean... And these are different to the pterodactyls, because I know that pterodactyls are not dinosaurs. These are actually flying dinosaurs. I love it. And surely that means people could have easily stumbled upon fossilised evidence of giant wings and made up their stories about dragons, right?
You know, it's a really, really nice idea. And if we imagine that someone maybe... in China, for instance, 3,000 years ago, might have come across a beautifully preserved dinosaur skeleton. It's a really nice story to think that maybe that they might have interpreted this as a dragon, if they already had dragons in their mythology, or that they saw a fossil and thought, okay, how can I describe this? And maybe dragons came from a certain sort of fossil. It's a really, really nice story, but we have to be careful at this kind of storytelling, because we actually don't have very much evidence at all to support that story. And although it sounds really nice, we have to think, you know, is that actually accurate? Or is this us looking back in time thinking, hey, that's a really nice story, it fits this tale really well?
Oh dear, and we were doing so well. It looks like our theories aren't convincing everyone, Kieran.
Including ourselves. All of our theories seems to be leading us nowhere. You know, Nick's right, it's impossible to say whether dinosaur bones were the route into dragon stories, because dragon stories have been around for longer than the written words in some cultures, so there's no trail that leads us back to where they came from.
Okay then, so reluctantly let's put this dinosaur theory to one side for now, because I would have bet money on that. I thought there was a good bet, but yeah, we've got to listen to the experts here. So is there any other explanation? Can we just look somewhere else and find evidence of real life dragons? Can we? Come on, I'm desperate to find one.
Hello, this is Matthew Cook from Chester Zoo. I'm a lead keeper of herpetology, and my specialism is Komodo dragons and also snakes and crocodiles. But dragons have been something that I've been working with for over 12 years, so I've had a lot of experiences with them over the time, and I'm here to talk a few of the incredible things there is to know about Komodo dragons.
Komodo dragons! Of course! Here we have it, actual real-life dragons. I mean, where does that name come from? Are they really dragons?
So the name dragon came about when the first people saw them. They just resembled a dragon or a mythical dragon. And I think they absolutely live up to that name. If you see one, like, stomping around in their habitat, like they own the islands, which they really do, for their namesake, Komodo, and the other islands that neighbour them, they really do resemble something that's a bit different to a lizard. Very prehistoric. It wouldn't be unfair to kind of compare them to dinosaurs. I always think, well, you know, if the Komodo dragon wasn't on Earth now, but there were remnants of them, like fossils, people would be like, God, wow, I'd love to be able to see, if only they still existed, because they're that inspiring. They're that sort of, they're definitely a megafauna, that's for sure.
I love Komodo dragons, I have to say. They are really fascinating, and if anyone listening to this hasn't seen one before, then it's worth looking them up online just to see what they look like. There are actually quite a few different species of animal alive today that have been named in honour of dragons. So there are Chinese water dragons, flying dragons, and pink dragon millipedes, to name a few. But I think Komodos are sort of the only ones that really resemble a mythological dragon in any real sort of way.
Well, yeah, they're a hard one to summarize, really. I suppose instantly the sight of them, it brings awe to everybody, because they're the largest lizard in the world. And it's not just like they're slightly the largest lizard in the world, they're by far. There's nothing that really compares to a Komodo dragon. They are in the monitor lizard family. And there are a few other, when they're smaller, they certainly resemble a lot of the monitor lizards, but there's nothing quite like an adult Komodo dragon. And the fact, the way they eat such large food items as well, not quite usual for a lot of other lizards, really, being able to kill a buffalo or a deer. And the mouth packed with the famous venom and bacteria, always the things that people want to know about. And obviously, the question that I get asked is a lot is can they kill you, or are they dangerous? And the truth is somewhere in the middle. They're certainly dangerous, but they rarely really attack people.
So here we have it in my best David Attenborough voice: a huge reptile with a mouth dripping with venomous, acidic alien spit, capable of taking down mighty prey. This is sounding a bit like a dragon to me.
And you are sounding nothing like David Attenborough to me. His job's safe. You're right, though. We're in the dragon realm at last, it seems. And Komodos have a pretty magical ability as well.
My favourite dragon fact that we came to learn only in a few years ago, really, is that Komodo dragons can reproduce without a male. So at Chester Zoo, we had an animal called Flora, and I actually named my daughter's middle name is Flora, Ella Flora, because of this dragon, because she was so special. She produced a clutch of eggs, and lizards will produce eggs even without males. They're usually infertile. You just get rid of them. This dragon had never been with a male, ever, in its entire life. We knew, because it was a captive animal. And it laid a clutch of eggs. And we decided, oh, let's keep them. And this form of reproduction isn't unknown in the animal kingdom. And it turned out the eggs were actually fertile, and they hatched. And every one of those dragons was a male. So a Komodo dragon, this is completely new to science, and it was about, I don't want to get the year wrong, it was early 2000s, and maybe 2006. And this dragon had produced actual male Komodo dragons in an environment where obviously it felt deprived of a male, and it thought, I know, if there's no males around to breed with, to produce the next generation, I'll make them on my own. And for an animal to do that, like a Komodo dragon, is astonishing.
That is amazing. We're going to have to do a creature report on the Komodo dragon. This is amazing. What a clever trick for survival. Fantastic.
They are so great. The more you look at them, the more there is to understand about what goes on with Komodo dragons. And, you know, I guess the link between Komodos and dragons, you know, the dragons that we mentioned at the start that appear in fairy tales and myths and legends. You know, that's as hard to prove as that link that we had for a moment between dinosaurs and dragons. You know, it's possible someone might have seen this huge venomous lizard like the ones on Komodo and created a legend around them, but we don't know that for sure either. I sort of get the feeling, Dan, that, you know, nature, either alive nature like Komodo dragons or fossilized nature, could definitely have inspired at least some of the world's dragon stories, but we just can't say it for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment there, really. I mean, whatever the truth of the matter is, these dragons are just this kind of overawing representation of the power of nature, and their stories remind us of the mystery and awe and things that are unknown still in the natural world.
And this is also what draws, I think, current children's writers to the subject of dragons, or, you know, adult fantasy writers, because of dragons representing wildness and our relationship with wildness. And often we feel like we're so in control, don't we? We feel like, oh, we're so clever. Not like in Viking times, you know, we can go around the world in a single day, can't we? How clever we are. But then one shake of an earthquake, yeah, and our cities are razed to the ground. One volcano and we, you know, our civilizations can topple just like that. We're not as clever as we think we are. And I think that's what's so interesting. That's what dragons represent, our relationship with the wild. That's what they certainly represent in my books. How we think we can tame it with the dragon riding and everything, but how really we need to respect it, because the wild and the environment is bigger than we are. And we need to look after it.
That's a very important message, I think, about, yeah, how dragons can connect us to nature and why we need to care for them and for the environment. And I'm sorry, Dan, we didn't find any proper dragons, but I think we still had a pretty good tour through the dragon-like creatures of the past and of today.
Yeah, we didn't crash and burn on that one, did we? I've really enjoyed just going through these incredible stories that were based around dragons and in the natural world and in the past and in the time of dinosaurs, and just basically discovering some of the mystery and wonder around it.
And if anyone listening to this enjoyed it as much as we did, let us know. You can get in touch with us by email. We love to hear your videos and audio clips in particular, but you can also write it down and send it in to hello@science-nature.co.uk. Or, of course, you can leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts from.
And remember to pick up your copy of Science and Nature for even more mysteries of science. Just like dragons, science and nature is head and smoulders above the rest. We've got lots of other great features, stories and photos, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with our next investigation.
Next time on the podcast, we are going to be getting ready for the winter solstice with a look at stone circles. There's lots of mysteries wrapped up in them, and we'll be finding out the fascinating stories of how and why they were made. But until then,
stay curious.
If you want to get your hands on a copy of the Week Junior magazine, we're offering a 6-week free trial. To get yours, head over to dennismags.co.uk/theweekjunior and use the code PODCAST.